Well, thank you, Bob, and good afternoon to everyone. It's a real thrill for us to be up here with all of you. Just by way of introduction, Common Ground Christian Ministries was started back in 2004, and what we've been kind of on a path or a journey is to understand how we can be more effective in our area in outreach, evangelism, and being tools in God's hands to help people come to understand Jesus Christ and become committed to Him and our Father in heaven. I say it's been a journey because there's a lot of things that I've had to kind of unlearn, not so much doctrinal things, but more things about how we approach people and how we connect with people. And we're seeing some, I think, some new opportunities and new avenues. One of the things that we've done is, as Bruce mentioned, you know, that is the first piece of literature that we put out. We've designed it not to be denominational in the sense of having, you know, common ground on it. It's really designed as an evangelism tool for congregations. You can put your own, you know, for more information, contact, you know, you, your pastor, you know, your congregation. And we've downplayed Common Ground's role in that. But what we're trying to do is augment the literature that's out there and augment tools like that with things that can be effective in connecting with people at their point of need. And my wife came up with the title, you know, if God so loved the world, why are so many people going to hell? And it raises a question that we found a lot of people, even people in my office when we were doing the prototypes, we were printing them out on our office laser printer, and people, I had my evening staff and actually even people during the day take a few minutes and fold them because that's a lot of work to do, and then we'd staple them. A number of people in my office said, hey, can I keep a copy of this? Which we said, no, there's no way. We also, one of the things that we feel is an area that we did not have a lot of expertise in was in doing outreach into neighborhoods and areas where the poor lived, where there was a lot of need. Several years ago, we started what we call Camp Outreach. This year, it's from July 11th through 17th. And we do it, we've done it in different states and different locations. And last year, we made a conscious effort to find a neighborhood in Indianapolis where we could focus and kind of adopt. And it's really created a tremendous amount of goodwill and a lot of open doors. We go in, we save money, people donate, and then we go in and we find people who have need, for example, senior citizens who own their homes, widows, orphans, you know, the fatherless, you know, a lot of single parents. And we rehab houses, we do painting, we put roofs on, siding. We've just done a number of different projects. And part of it is to meet the immediate need. Another part, and in fact an important aspect of what we do and why we do it, is to get to know people who have a need for Jesus Christ. And it's hard to talk to somebody that you don't know about Jesus. It's hard to know what to say to them unless you know them, because we don't know exactly what their needs are or how to connect with them. So Camp Outreach has been our way of doing this, and we invite other people to come in, partly to help us, but also so that people can see how it's done, and if it's something that fits a ministry that they might do in their own areas, it gives them a chance to learn from our experiences and our mistakes and kind of jumpstart their own neighborhood ministries. In our neighborhood ministry, we also have been teaching English as a second language, a need that we identified Jennifer taught 8 weeks of that this year, so we've made a whole bunch of friends in the Hispanic community. And now I have to learn to speak Spanish, which I'll do, God willing. In our camp outreach this past year, we also did what we call first outreach, was for little kids. And it was for the families of people who were coming to help with camp outreach. They had little kids, and some of them, and we needed something for them to do. And then we thought, well, why don't we do this for the neighborhood as well? So we had about 20 to 25 kids come every day. We'd feed them breakfast, feed them lunch, have a Bible study, you know, a Bible story, crafts, activities, games. And it was enormously successful. In fact, we continued it through this year. Once a month, we go back into the neighborhood. And the most we've ever had, both in workers and in kids, is about 67 people to 70 people. And so we're a small group, 3 weeks, and then 1 week we just explode. And we've had about 40 kids from the neighborhood come. Again, at the top, usually it's somewhere between 25 and 40. And we're getting to know the kids. We're teaching them about, you know, the Bible, about the main characters, about moral principles. We're introducing them to God and to Jesus Christ. We're praying with them. And it's really been an amazing thing. And we're getting to know families, again, who need to know Jesus Christ. We've also got a ministry house now that kind of a shell of a house was donated to us. We've hired some local men who are unemployed to rehab the house, and that's going to become our base of operations right in this, you know, very poor neighborhood. And we've been learning a lot about people who are suffering the ill effects of sin in their lives, the consequences of addiction, the consequences of, you know, just simply not knowing basic moral behaviors. And it takes a terrible toll on the lives of these people. And, you know, we're coming to know them as friends. And it's giving us an opportunity to begin to interact with them. So that's a little bit about Common Ground Christian Ministry. Again, we're a very small group, but we have a lot of people engaged in ministry. And God has certainly opened a lot of doors for us. In today's message, I want to start out by telling you a story of Carol Ann and David Vetter, V-E-T-T-E-R. Carol Ann and David were married, and in 1968, they decided to start a family. I'm guessing really in 1967, because in April, their daughter, Catherine Vetter, was born. They loved this little girl. Everything went fine. And so, a couple years later, in 1970, Carol had conceived, and David J. Vetter III was born, a little baby boy. But when he was born, things started to go wrong in his life almost immediately. He began to be sick, and what they identified as the problem was he had severe combined immunodeficiency, SCID. You know, you hear about AIDS and how it attacks the immune system, and the body can't fight off infections or it begins to attack itself. In this case, immune deficiency is there is no defense. There are no T cells. There are no things in the body that keep the body healthy, that fight off the viruses and bacteria. And before they could really do anything, little baby David died. Well, the couple were astonished. They had had one healthy baby, and now their second baby died of this unusual disease. Of course, in 1970, you know, that was hard to believe, 40 years ago. And in 1970, there was work being done and studies being done on the impact of genetic predispositions to these different diseases. They talked to some genetic counselors and determined that there was a likelihood that if they had another baby, there was a 1 in 4 chance that this child would have the same disease. And after considering what the options were, what the risks were, Carol and David decided to try to have another child. She conceived. They did an amniocentesis and found out that the baby in Carol Ann's womb was a boy. And as a boy, he had a 1 in 2 chance of carrying SCID, this severe combined immunodeficiency. They gave her the option of having an abortion, and she refused. Bone marrow transplants back then was a way to try and deal with these types of diseases. But bone marrow transplants 40 years ago, it was in what you might say its infancy, and it required a near perfect match of bone marrow. Well, they had baby Catherine, now several years old, and they determined that if the new baby was able to be carried to full term and born, they had a game plan in place so that they could take this new baby and transport this baby into a germ-free world. This new baby was born on September 21st in 1971. They named him David Philip Vetter. David Philip was born. He was exposed to this world for 20 seconds as they took him out, cut the umbilical cord, and moved him into this plastic insulator bubble. And this bubble that the baby was put in protected the child from all the germs and diseases. The air was filtered. Food was rendered germ-free. By October, they determined that David Philip indeed had this SCID. And so they began to work on what they would do. Now again, this is 40 years ago. Many of the advances in science, you know, that we think about today had not really been perfected. And some of them had not even been thought about. So from September 21st, when David Philip Vetter was born, until November, he stayed in this little isolator protective bubble. Around Thanksgiving, they determined that they could take the baby home. The baby was healthy as long as it never contracted any disease. And so they arranged for this isolator, you know, bubble type arrangement to be made portable. They loaded the baby in an ambulance. One of the doctors, Dr. Wilson, went with them. And the baby went in the ambulance with Dr. Wilson, and the family followed. Unfortunately, the ambulance drivers, thinking they're ambulance drivers, flipped on the siren, flipped on the lights, hit the gas, and rocketed ahead, and the parents left behind couldn't keep up. And then the ambulance drivers got lost. And so they have this baby in this bubble, lost, trying to find their way, you know, to the parents' home. Finally, Dr. Wilson said, "Stop, stop." Went into a convenience store, got directions, and finally got the baby home. Mom and Dad were there waiting anxiously again. Remember, there was no such thing as a cell phone 40 years ago. I know it's hard for some of you younger people to believe. So they determined later that next time they would rent a van or borrow a van from a friend, and the parents would drive them back and forth. And this is where, you know, many of you have heard, and there have been even made movies about the bubble boy. The little boy who grew up in a plastic bubble. John Travolta starred in one of the movies. There was a later, another, you know, takeoff kind of a comedy on, you know, a boy growing up in a bubble. But you see, for this boy, little David Phillip, the world was toxic. Any germ, any virus, he had no defense against it. And so he could not allow himself, and his parents couldn't allow him, to be contaminated by the outside world. It would compromise his immune system. And so, as the boy grew, things happened. In 1972, there was a neighborhood power failure. They didn't have a backup generator. And the air that was blowing in, this filtered, you know, protected air, stopped blowing. The bubble started to collapse. The parents frantically are grabbing, you know, duct tape or whatever, and they're taping all the holes to keep what air they could in there. Neighbors are sent out to find a generator, you know, and they end up getting a backup generator installed. The fire department knew that if there was any issue, they had to go there, and what the circumstance was, to check on David's house as a priority. By October of 1972, little David is now 13 months old. He's growing physically just fine. You know, his health is good. He's eating well. But his verbal skills aren't progressing. And so they realize that something needs to be done. A speech pathologist trains the medical staff while they're caring for the baby to talk aloud to the baby and start naming things like a mother would. And his verbal skills pick up. In 1976, this story that I mentioned about the bubble boy, a boy in a plastic bubble starring John Travolta as a teenager without a functioning immune system is shown on ABC television. And in this film, this boy has kind of like a space suit. And David sees the film and he says, "No, there's no such thing as a space suit. That's terrible. NASA creates a spacesuit for David. One that allows him to go about into the outside world, inside this suit, and still be protected from contamination." Unfortunately, David has a growth spurt, outgrows the spacesuit, and once again, he's locked inside this bubble. And his world is this bubble. Whatever can be brought in, whatever can be seen, all of his world is this bubble. On October 21st, David is 12 years old now, 1983. And they've been studying and researching. Bone marrow transplants have become more advanced. And the decision is made to try a transplant from his sister, Catherine. Catherine flies to Boston. Her bone marrow is extracted. They treat it. Dr. Shearer flies from Houston, or flies to Houston with the marrow. David is given a syringe with his sister's marrow in it, and he's shown how to inject it into himself. And the way bone marrow works, you know, it goes through the bloodstream and it'll actually go into the bone, and that's where the blood cells are created, that's where a good chunk of the immune system, especially those things that are related to cells, That's where it occurs. And the hope is that David will benefit from his sister's bone marrow and begin to develop an immune system. In essence, his sister's immune system. And that will allow him to leave his bubble. That was October 21st. February 7th, 1984, David begins to be sick. Not just sick, deathly sick. He's vomiting, diarrhea. He can't care for himself. The family discusses it, asks David. And David says, I've got to get out of here. He leaves the bubble to receive medical treatment. His mother runs her gloved fingers through his hair for the very first time. February 22nd, 2 weeks later, 4 months after receiving the blood marrow transfusion from his sister, David Philip dies from lymphoma, a cancer. Later it was determined that it was introduced into his system by the Epstein-Barr virus, and they hadn't screened for that virus in his sister's blood. It's a sad story in a lot of ways. Heroic efforts to save a baby who came into this world with a deficiency. Now, David wasn't the only person ever born with SCID. They took from the blood samples that they drew while treating him. They used his blood and that of others to eventually isolate the gene where the deficiency was located. And part of David's legacy is that they identified the gene. And with babies now, they take some of the baby's stem cells and through a genetic treatment, reimplant those baby's stem cells after they've been modified. And the baby then is able to develop its own immune system. There's still some side effects, there's a cancer that can occur. But through the experience that the doctors had with David and with others, a treatment has come to help little babies born with SCID. Thinking about a baby in a bubble, and a little boy in a bubble, and a boy who's almost a teenager in a bubble, it's kind of hard to imagine living your life in a room. Now, those of us who are parents and have teenagers, there's a time if you gave them, threw some raw meat in there or maybe some peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and they had an Xbox or a PlayStation, they might think it's actually a great thing to stay in their room all the time. Give them TV, cable, and an Xbox, and that at least some boys would be happy. But it's kind of hard to think about living in a bubble. But I want to tell you something. I am an expert bubble builder. And I have built bubbles my adult life. And especially when I got married and then had children, I became a really good bubble builder. Let me tell you about some of the bubbles that I built. Where I lived wasn't just where the cheapest place was. And if you know Guy, you know that me not going for the cheapest is really a struggle. The people who know me, if you want a cheap, call Swenson. I'm a diligent shopper. Not for clothes and for those things, but get me on eBay and I'll get you the best deal that's out there. But I never chose where we lived solely based on price. Even when it was just Jennifer and myself, we picked areas that were safe. We wanted a safety bubble. I don't regret that. We picked areas, you know, when we had children, that were both safe and were in a good school area, a good school district. We were told in 1987. I was an assistant pastor in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and we were told that I was being transferred to be a pastor in Beckley and Somersville, West Virginia. And I can't tell you how many of my friends, when they found out, called with a voice of sympathy. Now here you are leaving metropolitan area of Milwaukee and going to hillbilly Appalachia, you know, West Virginia. And education is very important for my wife and I, you know, for our kids. And there were not a lot of good things said about West Virginia schools. But I'm a bubble builder, and I'm good at it. And we found a neighborhood that had a good school district, interviewed the principal during the summer, and we decided, you know what, we won't homeschool the kids. That's what the previous pastor had done. We'll see how this goes. And to this day, we look back on those years spent in that school district with that elementary school. And I have no regrets. My kids had an excellent elementary education. Again, because we built a good bubble. Our kids were protected. Our kids, you know, we went to an area of similar morals and similar values and similar standards. You know, where we shop, it's in a bubble. You know, there's some places in the Indianapolis area that I don't want my wife shopping, period. Because it's outside of our comfort bubble, our comfort zone. It's in an area where there's a higher risk of people being assaulted in a parking lot. I'm a good bubble builder. You know, even who we have over to our house, you know, there's a bubble. Part of being a bubble builder is for safety. Part of it's, you know, for good opportunities. There's a lot of things that we look for in bubbles that I look for when I'm creating a bubble. We also can look at the world, you know, world in quotation marks. Remember back in the book of James in chapter 1? Where it talks about pure religion. Remember what it says there in James chapter 1 and verse 27? It says, pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this: to visit the fatherless and widows in their affliction and to keep himself unspotted from the world. And you know, in one small way, it almost justifies my bubbles, doesn't it? You see, if I keep the world outside of my bubble, I'm unspotted. My wife is unspotted. My kids are unspotted. There's only one problem. That's not God's opinion at all. He doesn't agree with all my bubble building. Now, some of my bubble building I think God's okay with. You know, picking where we shop, picking where we live. If we're able to do that, there are some benefits. Watching out for our kids and making sure that our kids are supervised and that there's a bubble of people watching over them, and especially ourselves, that have high morals and high standards and high values that won't let the kids just run, hither and yon and get, quote, into trouble. They get into trouble inside the bubble, but, you know, there's some aspects of that that, you know, it makes sense and it's sound thinking. But God doesn't seem to endorse a bubble for everything. In 1 John chapter 2, 1 John chapter 2 and verse 15, it says, "Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him." You know, when we think about the world, we don't want to be spotted by the world. In other words, we don't want the world's values. God doesn't want us to adopt the values, the principles, the precepts, the approaches, the things that the world loves. God doesn't want us to love those same things nor be enamored with the world. Because if the world, and I'm talking about people who don't love God, who don't want to obey, who don't have a relationship with Jesus Christ, people who just want to do what they want to do, people bent on fulfilling their own will, their own desires, their own lusts, their own whatever they want, that's the most important thing to them. That world, its ways, its values, its beliefs, its antipathy, it's against the way of God. And if we embrace that, if we learn to love that, if we succumb to that, it replaces the love of God. It drives it out. Just like the love of God drives out a love of the world. But even more so, I wonder if in my bubble building, and maybe in your bubble building, it's like we think Christians have a severely compromised immunodeficiency disease. And just think about it for a second. Are we suffering from Christian SCID? Are we ones who have a weak immune system? Is that why God says that, you know, we shouldn't be, you know, we should be unspotted from the world and not love the world? Is it because we have this weak immune system and a little bit of the world will so infect us that it can cost us our lives? Now, before you say no, just stop and think. You know, I want to be protective of my kids, protective of my wife. And sometimes when we're protective, we treat those that we want to keep safe like they have no defenses. And I sometimes wonder if those who were my teachers thought of me or thought of the Christians in their congregations as being compromised in their immune system. Now, God doesn't want us to love the world. God doesn't want us to, you know, just throw ourselves in it and get stained from it. But are we compromised as Christians with our own immune system? Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and in verse 9, he said, "I wrote you an epistle not to company with fornicators." Now, does that mean if there's somebody who's a fornicator, we're not around them at all, we stay away from them, you know, we don't? Well, he says this, "Yet not altogether with the fornicators of this world." Now, he's talking about people who are not Christians. "Or with the covetous or extortioners or with idolaters." Now, this is talking about the kind of sin that is endemic in the world. And Paul's saying, it's not that you shouldn't be around those people. He says, if that were the case, "For then must you needs go out of the world." You know, you'd have to be on a spaceship someplace, or you know, on the space station, you know. And even then, you couldn't have people around you who were part of the world. That's not what he's saying. He's saying it's not that you shouldn't keep company with people in the world who are, and get this is a big word, sinners. In the world, there are lots of sinners. Now, in the church, guess what? We have a lot of repenting sinners. I've never met a person in the church who didn't sin. I did meet one, and this is a legitimate true story. I did meet one man who said he never sins. You know, pride's a terrible thing. But Paul isn't saying not to be around sinners. No, he says, and in verse 11, he says, you know, if it's somebody who's one of the brothers, somebody who's a fellow Christian, and then they go about and they begin to practice a worldly lifestyle and go back into sin, he says, you got to do something. You just can't let that sit. You've got to go out. You got to talk to them. You got to confront them. You got to help them. You got to encourage them or her. But you know what the Bible talks about? Is not this building a bubble around ourselves. Now, I'll tell you, living in a bubble, you know, we Christians, we've got our own version of the Xbox and, you know, peanut butter sandwiches and cable TV. I mean, we can make our own Christian community very comfortable. We have friends. You know, our kids have friends. You have meals over at each other's house. Is that a bad thing? No. Is it a bubble? Did Jesus live in a bubble? Now, we don't know much about what Jesus' life was prior to his ministry. There's just a very few verses that talk about, you know, he lived here and then he lived there and then he moved back. And we don't know a whole lot of detail. The detail that we know about is what happened when Jesus began his ministry. And Jesus, in his ministry, did not conduct himself like the religious ministries of the day. Now, there were religious ministries of the day. You know, the Pharisees had a religious ministry. They had an evangelism program. And Jesus didn't fit in their bubbles. He didn't act like they did. In the book of Luke in chapter 5, and in verse 27, it says, after these things he went forth and saw a publican, this is Jesus, named Levi, sitting at the receipt of custom. Now, publicans were people who acted on behalf of the Roman occupying force. They weren't patriots. You know, they were almost traitors. And they worked on behalf of the occupying Roman army as tax collectors. And not only were they acting on behalf of the occupying army as tax collectors, they had a commission. And so they would oftentimes extort, in addition to what the legitimate tax was, all kinds of fines and penalties, and pocket that money. They were not esteemed Jews. But this Jew named Levi, Jesus walked up to him and said, follow me. And Levi got up. He left, you know, his books and everything sitting there, and he followed Jesus. Now, Levi, in verse 29, made for Jesus a great feast in his own house. And there was a great company, a whole bunch of these tax collectors who came in and ate, and others that sat down with them. Now, who are these others? They weren't Pharisees. They were sinners. Now, I want you to know, working in an inner city ministry has shown me that there are Christians who are committed to Jesus Christ and who make a mistake and stumble and sin. And then there's other people who are professional sinners. They live it. They work it. They work the system. They're not regretful. They feel ashamed sometimes, and they feel the consequence of sin. But They are good at it and they practice it every day. And when Jesus was sitting at a meal with Levi and his fellow tax collectors and these sinners, the Pharisees looked at that and said, Oh, you've got a problem here. In verse 30, but the scribes and the Pharisees murmured against the disciples of Jesus, saying, why do you eat and drink with publicans and sinners? Now, these weren't good Jews who sometimes stumble. These were practicing sinners. And Jesus, hearing this, answered them and said, that they that are whole need not a physician, but they that are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. Now I want you to stop and think about this. To whom did Jesus go? Where did Jesus spend his time? Where did Jesus focus his ministry? What kind of a bubble did Jesus live in? You know, when somebody is weak, or when somebody is young, you think about a baby growing in a womb. A womb is a bubble, isn't it? Right? It protects even a child with a severely compromised immune deficiency disorder. That disease. Even little David Philip grew in Carol Ann's womb and was protected from disease. And then he was born. There's a time and a place for a bubble. There's a time and a place to be in the womb. Babies grow in a bubble, in a womb. And then they are born. Christians, young, new Christians, are in need of being discipled and taught. But even then, I don't think Jesus leaves them in a bubble for very long. In fact, we're almost immediately sent back out. When Jesus said, who needs a doctor? What was the answer? Those who are sick. What was the example of Jesus? He went to the sinners, the people who had the most need. Now, did he talk to others? Yes. Did he talk to some Pharisees? Yes. Did he talk to Nicodemus? Yes. But where did Jesus spend his time in ministry? In some minds, the idea is that the world will get us. The world will cause us to compromise. Can it do that? Yes. Are there people who lose their commitment to Jesus Christ who act in a reprobate way? Yes. But healthy Christians have a strong immune system when it comes to a contagion from the world. Do you know what the chances, and I've said this a couple of times and you just watch, you know what the chances of me being shot in a bar brawl are? Do you have any idea what the chances of me being shot by somebody in a bar brawl? 50%? No. I mean, it's either me or the other guy, right? It's actually very small. Do you know why? Because I win all my brawls. No. What's the reason why? I don't go into bars, do I? I keep saying this because you watch, I'll get a bar ministry going. And I'll be shot. And he said, oh, what did he know about what he was talking about? You know, there's some places I'm not comfortable going. But I found in doing ministry work, there's a lot of places that I wasn't comfortable going before I'm totally comfortable now. Because I understand what the risks are. And I understand what the need is. And I also understand that, you know, while I could, just like you, any one of us could fall prey to sin. Any one of us could be compromised. While that's a possibility, I also see that when I go into an area to do ministry, it's almost like, and it's not because of me, it's because of all the people who do it like me, it's like we're carriers not of a disease, but of a cure. It's like when we go in, we're like an antibiotic when there's a bacterial infection. You see, Christians, it's not that God has created Christians with an immune system deficiency. Rather, we're like the transplant. We're like the fix. We're like the thing that makes other people healthy. And the only way that a doctor can treat patients is to be where the patients are or the patients come to them. One or the other. Doctors have to be in proximity with those who are sick. And I'm not talking about you practicing license without a certificate or a degree. But I am talking in the sense that there are people who have solutions, who have answers. But, how many of us, and I've been this way, in Luke chapter 14, in Luke 14 and verse 12, it says, "Then said he also to him that bade him," and I'm breaking into a story here, but Jesus is kind of correcting somebody, and he said, "When you make a dinner or a supper, call not your friends, nor your brethren, nor your kinsmen, nor your rich neighbors, lest they also bid you again and recompense be made you. But when you make a feast, call the poor, the maimed, the lame, and the blind." For years, when I read that verse, I felt a little pang of guilt. One, because I wasn't calling the poor, the maimed, the lame, and the blind. Two, I didn't know very many of them. Honestly, I didn't know. Why? Because I'm a great bubble builder. I'm a great bubble builder. I have my comfort zone. I have my friends. I have my church family. I have lots of things to do. But the question is, does Jesus want me to stay in my bubble? If there are sick people, and you've got the cure. If there are people who are dying because they don't have the right antibiotic, or if they're doing something that's causing them continually to be reinfected and reinfected, and you know how to fix it, but they don't know you, and you don't know them, how can the physician meet with the sinner? Christians carry the good news. Christians carry the solution. The solution for sin, the solution for being separated from God. And remember I told you about those professional sinners, you know, and they live this way. I'll tell you something else. The consequences from their sin hardens their minds, hardens their hearts. But deep down inside, they have a sense of guilt. They have a sense of foreboding. They're waiting for the axe to fall. They're waiting for calamity to hit them. Even some of the most hardened people out there, you know, they put on this hard act because inside they have a tremendous sense of guilt. the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 11. You want to talk about somebody who's an example of living outside of a bubble. And I'm not saying that this is what each of us should do. God's called us to do different things. You know, if you have a family, that's a responsibility. You know, as a Christian, you have responsibilities to your fellow Christians and your neighbors that are immediately around you. But the Apostle Paul was given a commission, a charge, a responsibility to preach the gospel and to plant churches all over the Mideast and even into Greece and other places. In Corinth, where he had planted a church, they had basically fallen prey to some false apostles, some false church leaders. Those church leaders were attacking Paul, attacking his credibility, making fun of him. And so in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, he gives an embarrassed rebuttal. Because these guys are talking about how hard they worked and oh, how they labored for the church, and that Paul, you know, he just goes around and, you know, does whatever. And Paul says, I'm going to defend myself like a fool. And beginning in verse 21 of 2 Corinthians chapter 11, he says this. He says, to my shame, I admit that we were too weak to admit, you know, he's already started into this debate. And he says, what anyone else dares to boast about, I am speaking as a fool. He's embarrassed by this. He says, all right, I dare also to boast about it. Are they Hebrews? Well, so am I. Are they Israelites? Well, so am I. Are they Abraham's descendants? Well, so am I. Are they servants of Christ? He says, I'm out of my mind to talk like this. Yeah, but you, all right, you guys brought it up. I'm going to answer your criticisms here. He says, I am more. I have worked much harder, been in prison more frequently, been flogged more severely. I've been exposed to death again and again. 5 times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea. I've been constantly on the move. I've been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my own countrymen, in danger from the Gentiles, in danger in the city, in danger in the country, in danger at sea, in danger from false brothers. I have labored and toiled and have often gone without sleep. I have known hunger and thirst and have often gone without food. I've been cold and naked. Besides everything else, I face daily the pressure of my concern for all the churches. We're not all Pauls, but this is a man who lives inside a bubble or outside a bubble. Now, we're not going to live a life likely like Paul lives. But today, I just want to put in your minds the question of whether you're living in a bubble. Whether you're as good of a bubble builder as I have been. And if God wants you to stay in your bubble. And if not, what do you do to get out of a bubble? Because once we're out of a bubble, we're out of our comfort zone, and we begin to connect with the sick. And who are the sick? Sinners. Occasional sinners? Some. Frequent sinners? Yes. Professional sinners? Some. Depending on who it is that God leads you to. But what do we do with them? How do we talk to them? You know, if it was just a matter of religious people thumping the Bible and telling them to repent, if that's all it took, that would have happened a long time ago. It's more of a challenge than that. And tomorrow, hopefully, we can explore that a little bit more and find ways to connect with people so that we can be tools in God's hands in the process that God has in place of drawing people to Him. You're not going to persuade somebody to become a Christian that God doesn't draw. But in the drawing process, God uses us as well as the work of the Holy Spirit. So think about it. You know, are you a bubble boy? Are you a bubble girl? And is that where God wants you to be? Is that where God wants you to stay? Or is there a better place, a different place, outside of the bubble that God wants to lead you and will open the door and path for you to get there?